You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Hello, I'm Danielle Derschlag. The artist Pita Coyne is a master of her craft. She's best known for her large-scale sculptures made in part from the unconventional materials she obsessively gathers. Major art institutions across the world, including the Whitney Museum, the Guggenheim, and the Museum of Modern Art, own her work, and her pieces can currently be viewed in cities as diverse as Seoul, South Korea, and Omaha, Nebraska. She is now preparing for a large solo exhibition at Gallery Le Long for the fall of 2018. I first met Pita as a teenager when I had the lucky chance to visit her in her studio, an afternoon that made an enormous imprint on me as an artist. Last week, roughly 20 years after our initial meeting, I got to sit down with Pita in her workspace once more to ask her about her relationship to materials and her path to becoming an artist. Pita, thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you.
So I just want to start out by saying that there's so many things that have been inspiring and compelling to me about your practice. One of the primary things I think of you, and I think a lot of the art world thinks of you, as one of the great gatherers. You gather.
That I do.
In a tremendous way. And yes. I wanted to start by asking about the work you're making now and what acts of gathering are happening right now and what's exciting you on your gathering journey at this moment.
Well, that is true. I do gather, and thank goodness we have a lot of square footage here because it is true. I always think of materials as a language, as a foreign language. And so when I see anything that I love, I gather lots of it and as much as I can possibly do. And I put it away. And sometimes you have to fight with it a little bit and find out like what it wants to say, what you want to say.
And that can take varying amounts of time, I'm guessing.
Yes, usually a couple of years. It's, I used to think I could do it faster because I thought I could control it. But anymore, it's like a dialogue. It's like
a dance.
It is like a dance. That's a really good way to put it. Exactly. Yes. Trying to find out, what it will do naturally that drew you to it, and then what you can inflict upon it that is maybe even more interesting, without it looking too pretentious. So there's this kind of fine line, and then you have to live with it a while, and you dial it back, you dial it in, so you kind of do this whole thing, and then sometimes you sit on it. And you can sit on it for a couple of years and
before it sort of talks to you
again
in the way that you need it to.
Yeah.
I mean, time with your work absolutely fascinates me because I was looking last night on your website, reminding myself of some of these amazing pieces. And sometimes it says, you know, the title of the piece, and then it says 1997 to 2003.
Yes.
Right? Or 1995 to even like, you know, 2010.
Yes.
Those kinds of spans of time. And it made me very curious about the rhythm in your studio with those pieces. Do those pieces go quiet for periods of time and then speak to you again? Or are they omnipresent for that many years? That's an amazing amount of time to live in relationship with an object.
With a piece.
Yes.
Yes. Sometimes it both, actually. And there was one piece, the piece that's in the studio now that's in the other room, it's called Chinese Wall. Mm-hmm. And it's because we used to look at all the Chinese paintings where it was all calligraphy. Mm-hmm. And my mother would say, now, can you imagine what is written there? And it's a letter. So what does it say to you? And we would look at it and she'd go, but, you know, it really doesn't matter. It's just as beautiful abstractly, you know, just look at it. And when I was building that piece, I started out with just this small little piece, and I thought it was going to be for an art fair, and actually the Chicago Art Fair way back in the 90s. And it was small, and then it had to be a little bigger, a little bigger, a little
that
bigger.
That piece started in the 90s?
That did, yes.
Wow.
And so we just kept growing it, adding it, and then pretty soon it needed to have pole, steel poles through it right through the floor to support its weight. And then we went around the back and made a back to it. And it reminds me of those churches in Rome where they, you know, it's 4 BC, 8 BC, you know, and it has all those layers and you can see the walls and all the different yes. discolorization. And I love that residue that's left, which I think is so interesting in pieces.
Totally. And when you say that, it makes so much visual sense to me, having seen of that piece, because what I feel so often in front of your works is that even though I'm seeing them at this exact moment in time as they are right now, they hold change.
Yes.
They really do.
Yeah.
Right? And, yes. and it's probably, you know, a result of what you're describing, that you allow them to alter as they want to for as long as that takes.
Forever. Don't let a piece come back to my studio that's sold. Do not. It's dangerous. I often do. Because they can change. They can change. And they as you change and evolve, the works change and evolve. You see something else, you see something fresh, and you think, oh, let me try this to it, you know, or let me try that to it. And I find that's what art should be. It's not about this one state of being. And I think that's so exciting. And that's what's really nice if you have a large enough studio to do that, to put something to the side. Sometimes they sit to the side.
Yes.
And I know they're there. I see them.
Yeah. And you can feel them, right?
Yes.
And when they
yes.
want to beckon you, I assume they do.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
I also like, I don't know if you will enjoy this, but I like thinking about the objects that I make not only not being static within my lifetime and my experience with them, but beyond me, right? Because these things are going to outlive us.
Yes.
Right? We'll leave our bodies.
Yes.
But God willing, our objects will still be here.
Yes.
And I like thinking about how they're going to change after that. Do you ever think about that?
Oh, well, yes, a lot. And especially because, but I've read a lot about Eva Hesse. Mm. You know, I talked to Saul LeWitt about this a lot before he passed, and it was a really interesting dialogue. Now, Eva Hesse said, "Let him change," and maybe she really, and I'm sure she really felt that when she said it. When I read it, when I was really young, I agreed with her.
Huh.
As I've gotten older, I'm not so sure now because, well, some of the pieces I think are interesting when they get really thick dust on them.
Mm.
But I guess I would like to have to be the one to make that decision.
Sure.
Because maybe some of the pieces with a lot of thick dust on them, I wouldn't like at all. So,
right.
So sometimes you would and sometimes you wouldn't. And so yeah. you want to say, this is really the state that I left the piece in, this is its pristine state. This is how you can maintain it in that state.
Right.
And please leave it in that state because I don't know how it would change. And I've made sure that all the materials we use can last forever, like the waxes and all the rest of the stuff. So archivally, it's a big question, but I don't think I want them like Eva Hesse's way they just degraded. I'm not sure I would be happy. I don't know what she would have felt. They looked so beautiful in those original rubbery states.
Absolutely.
So,
and also I think beautiful in their degrading states, but a different kind of beauty.
A different kind of beauty.
Yeah.
And I don't think we should remake them. Mm. I think they would be awful. But I also
and it would be shocking to hear if she could join us here in this third chair. It would be shocking to hear her say remake them.
I wouldn't think so. No. But even when you saw Joseph Beuys, when you saw those original installations that
yes.
he did, I saw a few of them in Italy or in Germany when I was there a long, long time ago.
Yeah,
and then they tried to remake some of his installations, and they just didn't have that edge. And I thought, I'm not so sure they should be remade. They just didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was setting up the blankets and the cane and the stuff. And it just didn't have, even though it was set up to the photographs, it just didn't have that spark or something, you know? And so I thought, Oh, gosh, this really questions much. It questions a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe people love that sort of thing, like where they like to set up artist studios. This is where they used to paint. I'm not so sure.
The physical changes, I think, are really interesting in terms of what artists want to control. But I also think a lot about how non-static work is in terms of its meaning and its context and its time. Mm-hmm. Right. And I love that we have no way of knowing who in 300 years, when someone goes to and sees a PETA coin retrospective, what the associations will be.
Yes, that would be very interesting.
Wouldn't you love to be a fly on the wall?
Yes, I would. And I so hope they will be able to put rooms of the pieces together, not just one or two pieces.
Yeah. How often do you get to see your work in that way in the institution where, like, there are rooms and rooms? Because I agree. I mean, these works, they so sing in a kind of symphony.
Yes.
When they fill tremendous amounts of space.
Yes.
How often do you get to experience that?
Well, I mean, on our last survey, we did that,
yes.
And that was in 2008, and it traveled to 6 locations.
Fabulous.
It almost killed us, but it was beautiful,
yeah,
to do that.
And are these materials, would you say, like, obviously these materials, a lot of us have relationships to wax, and we have relationships to hay, and, you know, we all grew up with those materials, but were you drawn to wax pretty early in your artistic process?
Unfortunately, yes. When I was 14, I was dealing with wax. It was we needed a potter wheel at the school, so I had this brilliant idea to make candles.
Mm.
So we made thousands of candles and we're selling them. And so I was making all the candles, and I loved the wax and the process of heating it up and making all these shapes and forms. And then when I started making the wax pieces, they weren't doing well in the, because in my first studio where you visited, there was no heat and there was no air conditioning. So the pieces were freezing in the winter.
Of course.
And then a scalding, because we didn't even have a window in the summer. So I used to work at Chanel. So I went to the man who was the lipstick guy, and he was the chemist. And I said, I got to make this stuff so it lasts. And he was like, oh, what a great project. Let's do it. He did this thing, and it's just been an amazing process.
It's fascinating to hear how, in a weird way, fashion comes in and out of your practice.
I guess it does.
Yeah.
With the couture.
Yeah, because earlier we were talking about these, we're sitting in front of this remarkable piece that's in process that involves hair and incredibly intricately sewn velvet.
Yes.
And you mentioned to me when I first came in that you're actually working with people who work in the couture industry.
Yes.
Right? So it seems like your background there, because I think you worked at Chanel for a while.
A long time.
Long time ago.
Yeah,
a long time. It's curious to see how it kind of comes in and out of your studio practice.
I hadn't even thought of it. Yes, of course it does.
Yeah. It's part of who
you
are.
Yes, I guess it is.
I'm curious because, you know, thinking about you as a young lady at Chanel, and I'm also thinking about you as that 14-year-old, which, to be honest with you, is very enjoyable to think about. You making candles as a 14-year-old. If I spoke to that version of you, that 14-year-old, if she was here, would she already know that you were going to be an artist?
Oh my God, yes.
Would she say? I'm moving to New York. I'm going to be an artist. I mean, was she that clear?
Oh yeah, she wasn't going to high school any longer. When I was very young,
yes.
I must have been like, I don't know, like most artists, you know, when you're really young, you claim it. And then, and we traveled all over the world. And then when I was—
Because your dad was in the military.
Military brat, we moved all over. And so— We were, every year we changed schools.
Mm.
And then when I was about, it must have been seventh grade, eighth grade, I said, enough of this school. I've got to become a serious artist. And they were like, well, you know, and they said, you have to go to school. And I was like, I don't need to go to school. I'm just going to be an artist. That's all I care about. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, if you can work it out with the head of the school, wherever we go, fine. And so I was like, okay.
What an amazing response.
Yes.
So generous, so progressive. That's an amazing, that was not especially, the response I was waiting for at the end of that story.
I was like, okay. They were like, oh, she'll never do that. So I went to the school and I said, you know, I'm very serious about this. I want to go to the university. I want to take these classes. What do I have to do? And they were like, well, you have to test out of this, this, and this. And I said, okay, give me the books. I'll study them over the summer and we'll test out. And so that's what I did. Every year I studied and then I tested out in the fall. And then I would go to the university. I did bronze castings, you know, everything. And my parents at that point, they had promised me. So I signed in for homeroom because it was against the state laws that you could not go to high school. So I would sign in, and then the school authorities asked me kindly not to leave by the front door because they were getting complaints from all the other students.
You know, by the way, that's so Midwestern.
I know, isn't it?
It's like, we'll make this work for you. We're happy to work it out. But could you not do it publicly?
I know. Kind of sleaze out the back door. And I was like, but I have to walk an extra 2 blocks. I was such a brat. And I got to get home to get my art done. And they were like, you know, really, PETA? And I was like, okay, you know, all right, I'll do it, you know.
And do you think that 14-year-old you, or even earlier than that, that being an artist was so just inside your DNA that it just came out of you? Or can you actually look at reference points like, oh, when we went to museums as a kid, I realized that was something I could be? Or was it much more just organically in your person?
Oh, I don't even remember when I knew I was going to be an artist, but I have all these drawings from when I was 2 and 3 of like a usual kid drawing of the house and the family. Then you turn it over and I have a drawing of my mother in a casket. Don't ask me why. Weird, you know, things, you know, and my mother was very sick and at one point and she left us for a while, and I remember, and I was really young, and I just
you were processing it through work.
Yeah, and I guess I just, and I found this drawing, and I was like, wow, look at that thing. My way and how I see the world, I think I always saw the world through that.
You know, I ask because it's funny the parallels that I'm noticing today with us, which I didn't know about. We're both married to compliance officers. Yes. That's the big surprise of the day, for sure. I can't wait to tell my husband that when I get home.
Or mine.
But also, the same was true for me. I mean, I don't remember a time where that wasn't evident for me. And I think, I don't know if you feel this way, but I think it is the gift of a kind of company in life that not everyone gets to have.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's company when you're a kid and you're figuring out how to be in the world. But there's this certainty. There's this thing next to you. It's a tremendous gift of company to have that as kids.
Yes, it is.
I think we're very lucky.
Yes. Oh, totally.
Right?
Totally.
And the fact that we've actually gotten to realize it is even luckier.
Yes. Yes. You know? Totally. That is so true.
Do you still feel that?
Oh, completely. I'm so blessed that I have a studio, that I have people that help me, you know, this I know, and that I have people that believe in my work that are there to, you know, help with the work. And I mean, it's always difficult. It will never be an easy thing, but it's so much easier. It gets easier and easier every year because you get more and more like sure of everything. And it's just the only thing that gets less and less of is, you know, the time, you know, it becomes less and less. And I never wasted time anyway, but now it's like, I don't even waste a second, you know? So, but I know I feel so blessed, and I only feel sorry for those that don't have all the options and all the things maybe that that you and I were maybe very lucky to have.
No, totally, I feel that way. too. And I've told you this already today, but I want to have it here on the recording, that when I did come and visit you as a teenager, and I was so lucky to get to do it, one of the things that really struck me was seeing a woman of your size. We're both short. And Peter, you're very petite.
We're so far.
And here was this petite, and I could tell Midwestern-sounding lady, very familiar to me.
Yes.
And you were creating objects that were holding space in the most confident, and I'm going to use this word with a lot of love, aggressive fashion. I remember sort of seeing you, a tiny figure, in a sea of enormous, hanging, seductive, difficult, complicated, wonderful sculptures. But what really struck me was the space that you insisted on them holding. And I wonder, at this stage in your career, is it still something that delights you to take up space with work?
Oh, definitely.
Really?
Space. I mean, that's what I really work with. So.
Well, probably why I ask about space is because, you know, when I went to a women's college, we talked a lot about sort of the way that childhood space is divided by gender, right? If you think about, I don't know if this is true for you, it was true for me, our playground experience. The boys had the field, right? Behind the school, usually. The field was always the biggest play space available. We girls would sort of create play around the parameters of the field, but we were almost never in the sporting event. So right from the beginning, there's this kind of subconscious message about how much space as a woman you take up.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because we would watch these boys run all the way across the field, like in a soccer match, and run all the way back. And their legs were just as tiny as ours, but they were commanding all this space. Meanwhile, we were playing a pretend game about princesses or lions or whatever it was, you know, in a corner, right? There's that early message about how much space you're afforded.
Oh, isn't that funny?
By gender.
Wow.
And when I think about artists such as yourself and Ava Hesse and so many others, one of the things that I really think about is just how beautifully and deliciously aggressive, even in 2017, it feels to me, for a woman artist to take up this kind of space.
Yes.
Does that resonate with you?
I never did sports.
Mm.
So I was never in a school long enough to do these things. So maybe, and I never went to the school.
Right, so it's not your association.
Yeah, and so I'm listening to you and I'm going, yes, I bet that is what they do. But I never did any of these things.
Mm.
I never.
So it wasn't like you were cramped. This isn't some kind of rebellion against not having enough space. It's just a natural expression of how much space you hold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
That totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never, it's so funny, I just go in a room and I feel the space and then I feel the size the piece should be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just and organically.
Yes, organically. Yeah. The only thing that I feel is that the hanging works, which I feel the most comfortable with, is they're maybe a bit aggressive. Mm. And that's because, but also more vulnerable.
Yes.
Because they're in your face, they can't move, but I usually try to greet you in the door somewhere or close to it. So they're there. But that also makes them really vulnerable because you can hit them.
Absolutely.
So they're both sides. So
I see that in all your work, Peta, so beautifully, that it sort of has, it's able to hold contrary energy very comfortably. But what I'm curious about is when you say those are the pieces that you're most comfortable with, what does that mean?
That's where I naturally go. I mean, if I only could make one last piece, I would hang. But I force myself to move to the wall. I force myself to try something on a table because I don't want to just hang. Because that can be like a real snooze. You know, you can make a formula of that.
Sure. And also, I have been lucky enough to be in rooms like you have here in the studio where there are many pieces and it's so dynamic to have hanging things and things on the floor and things, you know, they create a visual conversation that's super dynamic.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. I mean, for
so
sure.
You can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And if they were all hanging, it'd be kind of like, okay, we get it.
But you're saying if God forbid someone said to you, this is your last day in the studio, you can make a piece from scratch.
Yes.
It would hang.
It would hang.
It would hang.
Yes. Yes. That definitely, because that's, and I don't know why that is. I used to love how, because we moved all the time, they were always packing stuff, always packing. The military comes in,
right.
They pack you. 25 men come in, 7 to a room. They just pack you up. If you have trash in your trash can, it goes to your next house. And when they would take the chandeliers down, I loved how they would take the chandeliers down and they put them in these big barrels of like soft fluff. Mm. And it would just come down and they would just come into fluff. And it would just be like this descending into a cloud, you know, and then when they would arise out of the next house, it would just come out, and it was almost like pig pen, you know, all this dust would come out, and then the chandelier would be there, and you'd have to clean it all, but it would be so beautiful. There's that chandelier, and I'd always thought that would make such an interesting thing. And when I started making sculpture, you know, I started hanging. And it was the fish, and it was really because we were having a terrible rat problem.
So you're saying, you're telling me that your original hanging, for people who don't know, one of the things that you gathered at a certain point was dead fish.
Dead fish.
Right. Which, tell me if I'm wrong, but I remember you speaking about being really sort of beguiled by the way the light played on their skin.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right.
So originally you're saying the reason why that particular material had to be hung was because if you didn't hang it, it would be eaten by a rat. Am I hearing that correctly?
You are hearing that correctly. And it was so funny because Adam Gopnik just came out with his new book, and he lived in our building. He lived below.
Really?
Yes. And he talks about the rats that were in the building and how they would come up and they would eat. I mean, one point we had 1,200 dead fish hanging from our ceiling. I mean, I worked at Chanel every day. It was nothing but beauty. That's all the women talked about was beauty, beauty, beauty. And these women were having surgery so that they would, you know, take all the fat out of their legs.
Sure.
And then they would lay in bed for like 8 weeks because you couldn't move because you had to keep, I don't remember what the thing was, but you had to sit, you know, so that if you moved, something would, I don't know, but they couldn't move after the surgery for 8 weeks.
And they were sort of like temporarily mummified.
Mummified, you know, and I thought it was so funny in a way. But I remember reading Rauschenberg and his saying that if you walked down the street and you couldn't see something interesting, you really weren't looking. And Saul LeWitt said that you had to really reinvent yourself, you know, all the time. And I was new in New York, and I was trying to figure out, like, well, what am I as an artist? What do I look at? What do I think about? Right?
What zings for me?
Yeah. And I nothing that I was doing in the Midwest made any sense here.
Huh.
So I would walk down.
And that wasn't hanging stuff in the Midwest so much.
It was hanging stuff.
So already that was part of your vocabulary.
Yes.
Okay.
When I would go to Chinatown in the evenings and I would walk there, all these fish were so amazing. And it seemed almost horrible that people would eat them. Mm. And I thought, well, better for me to take them home, mummify them, hang them from the ceiling. I gave them a better send-off, you know, than someone eating them. So we started, every cent I had, I would buy these dead fish. I would just love these dead fish. And I became like an alcoholic. Every Friday I would get paid. I'd be down there buying, you know, these dead fish.
Did the fishmongers begin to know you at a certain
point? Of course. Oh, yeah. In fact, the Chinese women asked me. Yeah. They finally got up, you know, enough courage. Their English wasn't as good, and my Chinese is nothing.
Right.
You know, so they asked me, you know, why are you buying all these dead fish?
And what was your answer?
I just couldn't tell them I was hanging them from my ceiling. I just, because I had two basketfuls of dead fish, you know, and I was
right.
Like, I'm looking at
I'm imagining you in a Chanel appropriate
work outfit. Yes,
right.
Like, you know, just a beautiful outfit, and I'm looking at every fish. Back and front, checking the little scales. You know, I'm looking at everyone for about 10 minutes before I put it in my basket. So I'm spending 3 or 4 hours inspecting every fish, right? And they're all giggling. They finally said, you know, why? And they point to the fish. And I said, oh, I'm, I'm making soup for the poor. Just could not tell them. You know, I was like hanging.
Can I tell you what I love about that? It's such a great fib because it's got just the right amount of righteousness. Right. It's not just that I'm feeding people. You could have said, I'm a chef. You know,
I know.
I'm a cook at night, you know, something. But I'm a caterer. But I love that you made it about the poor.
I am Jesus. I am Catholic. I'm feeding everyone. And they were like so humbled that they said, we will give you a discount, you know. And the last thing you give to an alcoholic is a discount,
yeah,
right? You
terrible
do not
idea.
Give,
right.
You know, and I was like, oh, no, 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 no. And they were like, yes, yes, yes. And I'd be like, oh, this is my last time I can come shopping here, you know. Every time I would go by the store, they'd be like, hello, hello, hello. And I'd be like, hello, you know, fishy today? I'm like, no fishy today. And so, oh, gosh. But I love those fish.
And those were hanging pieces.
Those were hanging pieces. And we put them in trees. You know, we went and put them in someone's yard. We did it as a gift. You know?
Did they experience that as a gift?
No,
yeah.
They did not experience. And that was the last time I ever did a free gift anyone, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, it was in Garden City. We went all out there. We did it all night. We did it in their trees, their flower boxes, their clothesline, all over their yard, on their car. And I thought they would just think it looked like a tsunami had hit just their house.
Yes.
And nobody else's. It was so beautiful. I have to tell you, it was so beautiful.
Did you photograph it?
I photographed parts of it. But I thought we would take pictures together. I thought we'd have breakfast together. And we'd have esoteric conversations. I really thought. And I waited outside. I stood across the street. My friends went home. I stood there like the proudest peacock you ever saw, standing there like a ridiculous person. So proud.
You know what strikes me in this story, Peeta, is that in a way, from your perspective, you were feeding the poor, right? You were visually offering something delicious and succulent to someone who was lacking. Right? From your perspective. I can understand that wasn't their perspective.
Totally.
But what you said about Solowit is just, this example makes it so true. They didn't see those fish with your eyes. They couldn't.
No.
But for you, what greater gift
than to
visually feed them?
Oh. And I thought it was so beautiful.
Oh, sure it was.
Oh. And they came out, the father came out. I'll never forget his face. He dropped his suitcase or his little attaché case and just stood there for a few minutes and looked around like, you know, is this candid camera or something? And then started yelling at the kids. And I felt so bad. Like, look what your friends did. They didn't TP our house. They did this to our house. You clean it. And the kids all in their pajamas just standing there like looking. And I just thought, oh, I've made such a bad mistake. I just remember thinking, this is not good.
Well, that's when you know you need a studio.
Yes. And I should have gone to graduate school. I should have like talked this out.
So how old were you when you were buying these fish?
I was like 23, 24.
Okay. My question is now, at this stage in your career, what gives you that feeling that you used to get from buying the fish?
Oh, anytime I buy new materials.
Yeah, but is there a material right now that you're particularly thinking about that's singing for you?
I think the velvet is really beautiful and how we're treating it in a new way and making it beautiful but also kind of ugly.
Yes.
You know, at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Because even when I look at that kind of landscapey kind of thing, it also looks like somebody's bad teeth. With a mouth and stuff, like it's kind of like
we're looking at this ball piece that protrudes in this way that's kind of undular and almost like glamorous warts, if that makes
that
sense.
Glamorous warts, that's probably his name.
And that push pull that I see so often in your work is there. So you're telling me that right now, if I dropped you, Peeta Coyne, into a Venetian velvet shop, that would be the problem space.
Yes, yes. And this is all Venetian velvet. It's satin silk. You know,
yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's And we have blues and blacks, and that's what we're working with, the palette. But we did that one in brown and black because I wanted it to be ugly colors and see if we could work with the form.
I think it works beautifully, but I love the idea that, you know, if you're going to be an alcoholic in this way,
yes,
which clearly is your life's work,
yes,
I think you've moved from low-class beer. You know, yes, fish are beautiful, but they're yes, not that expensive.
No.
You've moved to, like, the finest of wines. Yes. I mean, this is gorgeous.
Yes.
Totally delicious to look at. Velvets.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But even with this material, it's wonderful to hear you talk and see it in the work about how you're fascinated and interested in pushing it to different kinds of limits.
Yes.
How beautiful can it be? How yes, ugly can it be? How can those things sit together?
Yes.
Right?
In the same thing. Exactly. Yeah.
Which yes, is what I feel that push pull all over your work. Peta, I want to say thank you for speaking with me.
You are welcome to come anytime.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.